Welcome to this week's episode.
What's up, buddy?
Rick, how long have we been saying we have some special things coming up?
We have been saying that for a minute, and let me tell you, I'm probably going to have to sit on my hands because the Italian in me is going to come out.
It's okay. I know you get excited. It's all right.
I do. You know what? It's an exciting time for us, and
it is.
You know, we're having fun, man. We're having a good time. It is.
And that's the thing with the podcast. Well, I get asked often, you know, how's it going? And this and that. My friends will say, is it growing? Or some other people. I mean, if it grows and blows up, hey, that's cool. You and I don't do this for any other reason, but we have a good time every week. We enjoy the conversation, either with each other or with guests. So that's really what it comes down to.
That's right.
But this week, we do have a very special guest in store for us here. He's a writer. He's a director, producer, jazz pianist, a podcaster.
The Academy Award nominee.
Academy Award nominee. Thank you, Greg. How can I forget that?
Festival winner.
I mean, this is an honor for us to bring this man on. But please welcome Mr. Raymond DiFelitta.
Hey guys,
and there he is,
Raymond. How you doing, Raymond?
I'm good.
Thank you so much for coming on, Raymond. We appreciate it.
Real pleasure. I was very appreciative to hear that you wanted me to. So here I am. I'm all yours.
Well, we truly appreciate that. I'm going to pop up a quick picture. We met you through Robert Bruzio, who did a screenplay called The Bottom of the Ninth that you had directed. And from there, we talked about coming on. And when we started doing our research on your career, man, I tell you, very impressive, Mr.
Woo-hoo.
Very impressive. Well, I mean... Yeah. So where should we start? For the jazz pianist. So let's start there with your piano CD albums. Were you always playing piano, or how did that develop?
Yeah, I've been playing since I was a little kid, and and I just, jazz was my first love. I loved listening to, you know, 1930s records when I was a kid, which was the 1970s. So I was, you know, you might say I was slightly out of step with my classmates. I was into Jelly Roll Morton and Fats Waller, and, you know, I don't know what they were listening to, Rush or AC/DC or, you know. I took to the piano really young. And I've played professionally on and off over the years. Filmmaking became my real focus as I grew older. But it's a great, you know, it's like a nice thing to have to escape to, because so much of your filmmaking life is just killing time waiting, you know, for money to come through or actors to commit. And it's a slow life. You have to be patient. And unfortunately, a lot of, I can't remember who said this, but it's one of my favorite quotes is, filmmaking is my hobby. My job is raising money. you do a lot more of the latter than you do of the former. So playing piano has always had, like, this, you know, this other creative outlet thing for me.
Is New Orleans a hot spot for you then?
No, that's that kind of New Orleans jazz, which is essentially traditional jazz or Dixie, is not my thing specifically.
Okay.
I started in the 30s. And moved my way through swing into bebop, into hard bop of the 50s and 60s. But yeah, that's really my thing. The American Songbook, which, you know, it's really heartening to see how it's lasted, you know, and been revived by newer and younger players and singers. But, you know, that's the basis of everything I love is Gershwin,
beautiful.
Porter, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen, you know, and playing jazz on top of those songs. You know, using their changes and using their melodies to improvise, which is really the heart and soul of what good, you know, jazz is.
Right. That's
for
awesome.
Me anyway. Yeah. Unfortunately, what I've noticed is that jazz has a bad rap. I don't know exactly when this happened, but it's the least popular music that you can download. It has like the lowest number of hits anywhere.
Really?
And I think that what happens is that, you know, people say they don't like jazz, but they haven't really heard it. They've heard something that they think, or someone said, like they've either heard free jazz, which is like when trumpets and saxes and drums are just wailing all over each other, or they've heard something like Kenny G, which isn't jazz at all, but sometimes gets, you know,
mixed into it. Yeah, it was like the 90s.
So I haven't really heard. Whenever people say I don't like jazz, I always say, "Well, have you listened to Lester Young or Billie Holiday or Art Tatum?" No, never heard of them.
Oh,
try that for before you say you don't like it, because that's what it really is. But that it's fallen out of the cultural mainstream. You know, the people who love it and the people who play it still are devoted to it. But I have a theory that, you know, there was a couple of hundred years where they didn't put on Shakespeare's plays. Shakespeare was not really, he was more or less in eclipse for a couple of hundred years. If you believe it, you know. And I kind of feel like, you know, the same can be said. There was a long period of Bach not being played. There was so I like to think that jazz is just in the dark ages right now. Oh, that's funny. How come they spent 100 years saying they hated this music? It's great. So
I love jazz. I have it on my TV where, you know, and it's very soothing. It's very relaxing, but yet it can get you going. And, you know, Billie Holiday, absolutely. You know, I'm not going to say I'm as well versed.
Like he said,
by no means.
Yeah, he said the American Songbook, it lasts around forever. And it will last around forever. Like you said, it might have a little bit of a hiatus, or it might take a little bit of a lull, which it kind of did. You know, I grew up, my parents listening to, you know, Sinatra say, and then those songs that were sung by him and by Dean Martin, there was a gap where they kind of weren't anymore. And then, like you said,
it's hard to remember this, but like, yeah, there was a period, I would say in like the 70s, maybe even 80s, where Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Tony Bennett were the least hip guys in the room. They were like the guys who showed up on, like, you know, the Jerry Lewis telethon or something, you know. So that wasn't cool. That was like your parents or grandparents, like them. Like, who are the coolest guys in the room now? Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Tony Bennett, they're idols. So, yeah, these things do come in cycles, I guess.
They do.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
So since you've been playing jazz from a child, you said, and your film career. So where did the film career come into play? Like, were you always a writer at some point, or did you always have creativity of, oh, I would love to make a movie? Or where did that start in your career?
Yeah, when I was growing up, we're from New York, but we moved to L.A. when I was a kid, and Los Angeles television in the 70s. Largely was old movies. There were like four channels and they didn't know how to fill them, you know, so you could get a great old movie education just because they didn't know how to fill airtime. Of course, they were chopped up with commercials and stuff, but I became, just like I loved old jazz, I loved old movies. Remember the summer Star Wars came out. I think I went with some friends and I didn't get it. I just wanted to be home watching, like, you know, Laurel and Hardy or screwball comedies from the 30s. So this was always my problem. I was always out of step in our culture when I was growing up. I should have listened to my taste then and just not gone to the movie business at all. I'd probably be a lot happier and richer. But but anyway, no, I loved that. And my dad got me a Super 8 camera, which was, you know, the iPhone. And I started making movies with my friends and I just took to it. I loved the process. I loved the, the odd series of things you have to do to get through a movie, conceiving it, you know, even then it's hard to like get them made. Even when you're 12, it's like, get your friends together to do it. And to get, you know, it was always a process, and then shooting and cutting. And I just felt very naturally like this was my forte. I never really thought of writing plays. I never thought of writing prose even, although I'm doing that now for the first time.
Do you remember, like, the first, when you're 12, 13 years old, what was the first type of movie you tried to make? Do you recall that by any chance?
Of course, yeah. What most of my first Super 8 movies with my friends were essentially remakes, or more accurately, ripoffs of Three Stooges shorts.
Okay.
Always like somehow detectives in a haunted house, or they were like guys running, like pretending they were the plumbers. Really weren't, you know. So I just would cobble together like a kind of a fake screenplay, just a few pages of situations.
That's awesome.
And they were essentially old slapstick, you know, comedy retreads. I actually transferred a few years ago from the Super 8, you know, and looked at them. And, you know, of course they're horrible, but there's odd things about them that are kind of cunning and interesting that I remember my friends and I figuring out how to, we actually did a car chase and none of us knew how to drive.
That's awesome.
And I was like, wow, how did we do that? Well, now I remember how we did it. We were in my mom's car, you know, just my two friends and I had a close up and handheld camera and making it look like they were driving. And then I got one of my parents, probably my mother, to take a drive around, and I shot out the window what we were doing. It's the least convincing car chase you've ever seen. Like, these guys are screaming behind the wheel, and then you cut to the POV through the window, and it's this really placid drive around the neighborhood. but I was trying That's to awesome. Figure out, well, how could I make this happen? You know,
yeah. It's very endearing, though. You know, it's so, you know.
Well, it's pretty creative considering what, you know, the age and the lack of experience and up with it. I mean, no education or training behind it. I mean, so you just kind of went with it. That's awesome.
Right.
Very cool.
Right.
Now, as Rick mentioned when you first came on, you know, Academy Award nomination for Bronx Cheer, Two Family House was a winner at Sundance Film Festival, and City Island, Tribeca Film Festival.
Yeah.
I mean, that had to be, obviously, I don't want to say bucket list, but maybe the bucket list items that were there. Any rehashing of the moments leading up to it, of getting the nomination, of winning the awards?
Well, you ever... I'll make sure the Oscar thing, it's really been very helpful for many years, even though, like, I didn't win it. It was for a short film category. So, you know, it's as far as Oscar noms go, it's a fairly minor one. But once you have that on your CV, it's always used. So whenever anything about me is printed, it always says Oscar nominated director. You know, I technically, but you know, it was a long time ago. It was when I was first out of film school, and the experience itself was quite unsettling. As a result, I actually rarely watch the Oscars because if you go, you see that it's a very different event in person than what you see on television.
Yeah.
And it's not a pleasant one at all.
One of my questions was, did you get to attend ceremony or any of the other ceremonies?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we went and hired a limo. And, you know, from the moment we got out of the car, it was a nightmare. Well, they don't know who's getting out of the cars, or at least they didn't then. I'm talking about 30 years ago. So everyone descends upon you. Hey, maybe you know, who was the big guy? I think the big nominee that year was like Kevin Costner and Dances with Wolves. So, you know, we got out. We're these like schmucky kids from the American Film Institute who got their movie nominated. And all of a sudden there's like paparazzi and we're getting pictures flashed and people are screaming. I was completely dislocated by it. And also it's in the daytime. So everyone's in these clothes and these get-ups and it's like LA, so it's really hot and nasty sunny and people are screaming at you, you know. And then what happens in it, you know, as you can imagine, if you think about it this way, it becomes a very unpleasant room, because as the ceremony goes on, 4 out of 5 people lose in every category.
Sure.
And it doesn't matter how much you know that, like, the chances are you're 1 in 5, you're not gonna make it. It's still like really dispiriting. You know, because you're sitting there and you're like, all right, I lost. So the room takes on this really weird energy. It just becomes a room full of people who are feeling increasingly sort of sullen.
Okay.
They then start to leave because it's like you don't want to sit there. And the Academy knows this is going to happen. So they have what they call sit-ins, which are like stand-ins.
Yeah.
They're waiting to rush in to your seat and sit there. Okay. Because they don't want the TV audience to see that people are leaving.
Okay.
And that the auditorium's getting empty. Everyone goes to the bar. Well, so you have a bunch of like people who are pissed off at the bar. Like, the whole thing is a really weird evening. And then at the end, they have a ball for the, you know, everyone gets to be invited. And again, it's just a lot of, you know, the year I was there, Francis Coppola was nominated for Godfather 3. And I think the movie won no Oscars at all. And this is a hero. You know, I had to go say hi to Francis Coppola, and he was pissed. He didn't want to say hi. He didn't want to talk to anyone. He was just a very angry man that night. And I just went home feeling like, all right, this was a complete bust. We didn't win. And Francis Coppola didn't want to like say hi to me. So.
Tony, that brings us, it kind of reminds me of the perspective we were talking about in the view from Cobra Kai, from Daniel's perspective, you know, and Johnny's perspective.
But you don't know until you talk and hear it. You don't know. Like you just said, Raymond, you see it all on TV. You see it, okay, the winners and stuff, the losers are, you know, clapping and
everybody looks happy.
But you don't see that other part of it unless you're there.
Yeah.
Hey, look how happy, you know, look how happy Will Smith was, right?
Yeah. Oh, you want to go down that rabbit hole?
Oh, that's funny. So, as we were mentioning earlier, you do wear a lot of hats. Does one like with your with? I know we know that you were screenwriter for excuse me, City Island, and for Two Family House.
Well, yeah, and director and writer, yeah.
So I mean that's a lot of hats to wear. Do you have internal fighting with you sometimes? Like I want to change this line, and as a director, maybe no. Or is it wearing that many hats comfortable because you're I get to control all of it? Enlighten us about that.
Actually, I actually find it easier if you do everything. Okay. In a way, okay. Because it's the writer in me knows that I have to give it up and let the actors kind of come in and make it theirs. And the director in me is happy to see that happening. Mm-hmm. I've taken a couple of producing credits. I've never produced a film all by myself. I've had good producers. But the truth is I am producing also, one way or another, I'm helping cast the film and get actors involved. And usually I'm trying to find financing. Bottom of the Ninth is an exception. I was hired onto that. It was already financed and already cast. Okay. A couple of times I've been fortunate to just get the call and say, hey, we've already done all this work. We're looking for a director. That happened with the Madoff miniseries also, which was all, it was a green light at ABC to do it, and I was hired onto it. But no, usually I am kind of producing along with everyone. So it feels to me, hey, listen, it's a little bit like making my 8mm Three Stooge remakes. It's got to be all running off my energy from the beginning. Sure. And so it's really not that, for whatever reason, that makes it simpler to me than if I just am doing one job.
So being with the writing process, if you're writing something down and like you just addressed the fact that you got to let your actors kind of take it in a direction they want to go. Is there any internal conflict? Like, I really wanted it to be this way, but I see that they're going that way. You know, you just got to kind of let it go.
I love seeing them take it over and do it their way. I have great love and respect for actors. I love that they take something that I created and they give it real life.
Sure. You
know, whatever's in my head. Once I know I have an actor cast or I get the star wants to do the movie, they're sort of rewriting for themselves. Even if they say exactly what's scripted, they're turning it into, it's their interpretation. And I always feel like, embrace that. And I've told this when I've spoken to like classes in screenwriting, because, they do ask, like, well, if I wrote it this way, are they going to, like, can I insist that they did, And I always say, you can try to insist, but you're not going to get the best work out of that. It's not what's in your head. It's going to be better if you let them, bring it to life. So am I going to tell, Sylvester Stallone, do it this way? He's terrific. He's going to give you what he has, and he's also a writer, of course.
His inflection. His voice inflections, his mannerisms could bring a whole other light. I love that. That's great. That's a great point.
Yeah. You have to be willing to, to embrace what the actor brings. Otherwise, you really shouldn't be making movies. You should write them. Okay. Then it's, and that's obviously like a great thing to do too. I think that a novelist is is an artist, like, you know, it's such a singular thing. You're reading, when you read a novel, you're literally going from that writer's head is going right into your head, and there's nothing in between you and the writer, and that's amazing, you know. But that's, if you don't want actors to translate that, then you shouldn't be making movies.
Right. And that's been shown several times with other, I'm sorry, Rick, go ahead. What was that?
Oh, I apologize. I was just going to say, you've worked with some pretty big name actors over your career.
Yeah. I mean, I've been fortunate because, you know, they bring their own weight and charisma and experience, and, Andy Garcia, above all, I've had a great collaboration and friendship with Andy. Andy's got 1,000 times more experience than I'll ever have. He's made, 100 movies. At the end of the day, I'm going to have made like 12, and because actors can work, and he's a star. He has been in demand for many years. So he brings a whole kind of other, bunch of ammunition. He can figure things out, he can pull out ideas, he can kind of reference things that he knows will work because he's done it, at the same time extremely receptive to like wanting to collaborate, he respects the writer lot. I had the same, a very similar experience with Richard Dreyfuss, who I directed in Madoff. This man has done so much work and such great work. He's going to come out with 10 different ideas for you, and they're all great. You don't know which one is going to be, but that's so much, it, like, on the one hand, it makes my job easier, but it also is just really inspiring. So it's to work with
that's amazing.
Actors and actresses who have that, that arsenal of tricks and experience and stuff. It's great.
That's amazing.
Andy Garcia has directed before.
Andy, yeah.
Go ahead, Rick.
Oh, I just had one follow-up question to that question. I'm sorry, Tony. I don't mean to step. The brain's just going. This is a question that Tony and I have discussed on many of our other podcasts as well, is when you get up into the upper echelon of where you guys are, we've always wondered, do you guys keep in contact with each other? Tony and I will talk, but sometimes you don't see these actors, directors, producers, whatever, these big name stars as yourself and whatever. I guess sometimes you don't see them as normal. So you're like, do you keep contact with them? Or is it just, we've heard that a lot of these stars, they'll do a movie or shoot or whatever, and then they never talk or see each other again.
Well, it depends if you get along. That doesn't always happen. Although I've never really had that issue. It's interesting with actor relationships. As close as you are when you're working together, it sometimes doesn't translate afterwards.
I've heard that.
And it's not because you don't like each other. It's that the intimacy of working with each other is really intense. Mm-hmm. That doesn't always translate to social intimacy. Having said that, there's, the actor relationships that are the most important to me, which are like Michael Rispoli, Andy, Frank Whaley, who I've worked with several times, who I'm working on something else with, Richard Dreyfuss. Okay. If we fall out of touch for months, we're going to, like, if I call or text or whatever, we're right back in touch and we're right back with the, But it depends. Also, they go away and work more. Like I said, I'm sitting around forever trying to raise money, and they've made like 9 movies between.
Yeah. Well, thank you for answering that, because you answered it much better than I asked it. So, but you definitely got my answer. The point across was,
any career, you work with if it's an office building, you work within your office. Some people you get along with, you leave that office, you go somewhere else. You may still stay in touch with some of those people, and some of them you won't. Right. It's probably just like anything else like that.
But where did we hear Tony? We heard that like with Rocky or in the making of the Rocky or something. It was like you're working side by side every day, but then you would think that they're like the best friends is what's portrayed on the screen, big or small, but yet they're like, I don't know who this person is, because we're just talking lines to each other. Yeah, that's where that whole
job. Yeah.
You
know, not every movie shoot is a pleasant experience.
Okay.
They're very tense. There's a lot of personality. There's a lot of money and tension. And you can't tell by watching a movie whether it was a good experience or not.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of excellent movies that it turns out were terrible shoots. Mm. And the other way too. There's like a lot of movies that are pretty dumb, and it turns out they all had a lot of fun making it.
Okay.
So you can't really tell, and it just depends, you know, and it kind of doesn't matter ultimately. Yeah. But you do have to kind of gird yourself when you go into a movie. It's a pressure cooker, and they're not all fun. Some of them you kind of wake up in the morning and go, really? This is what I've been trying to do for the last 5 years. I got to go again. You know?
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for addressing that.
Well, he did build a relationship with one gentleman that we wanted to talk about, and you seem to have had a long relationship with this person, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But Mr. Burt Young, who you worked with and then befriended.
I'm toasting Burt as we
became very close to him, from what we were told. There you go. Please do. I would love to discuss the. Please.
Bert and I was always really fascinated by him as an actor, because I didn't know a lot about him, but I knew that he was both a great actor and really not an actor at all. He came from a very different background. He didn't become an actor until he was almost 40. He essentially was one of those actors that played himself. You know, he had technique, but that's not what you like. What he traded on, really, he had great emotion and great pain. So he really, on some level, he played himself a lot. And I was always interested in him, and obviously the Rocky movies. But I saw him in The Gambler, which was amazing. Once Upon a Time in America. And I always wanted to meet him, and he was kind of a mysterious figure. And when I was making Rob the Mob, I had this part that I thought he might be interested in. And the casting director, George Ann Walken, said, oh, you know, Bert, you'd love him, but it's impossible to even get him on the phone. It's really a whole process. And I can try. He's very mysterious. He lives in Long Island, but you have to call like the local restaurant where he hangs out, and then they'll give him a message. And then you might hear from him or not. And there's no agent, there's no, you know, it was like really getting in touch with like someone in hiding.
That's great.
And I did. And we eventually went and met him. And he was very cagey. He kind of put on this act when I met him that it seemed like he had like dementia. He sort of acted like he didn't know why I was there or what I was talking about. And I was a little iffy. I was like, geez, maybe this isn't going to work. This guy might just not be all there. And then after about 20 minutes of this, he said, well, let's go to lunch. And he became a completely different person. He became, he just suddenly he was this other guy. And I realized later, I actually asked him about him. I said, did you do that? Were you kind of screwing with me for some reason? And he said, yeah. He said, I wanted to see if I liked you. Because if I didn't like you, you would leave. You'd say, oh, this guy's out of his mind.
Right, right.
He said, but I decided I liked you. So I said, let's go to lunch and I'll be
here. Oh my God, that's so awesome.
And that's Bert. He was a guy who spoke and thought in puzzles.
Yeah.
Oh, it's hysterical. Now, Rob, that was what, 10 years ago, Rob the Mob?
10, 11 years ago, yeah.
And so, and that was the first time you worked with him?
Yeah. I only had him for a day on that movie. It's a small part, but it was very important. but we stayed in touch and became friends. And I said, I want to make a documentary about you, because again, a very mysterious life and very colorful. And he said, okay. And we started shooting. And now I'm going to talk in puzzles a little bit, because it's a complicated subject. There were a couple of very, very significant things in his life that he would talk about privately, but that he was torn about talking about in front of the camera. He wanted to on some level, and then he didn't want to. It hampered the making of the doc, because I could never really get him to go where I thought he wanted to go. And at the end of the day, what I put together, and it's done, it's, you know, to the extent that it is, it's still a work in progress in some ways. It leaves big questions unanswered. Okay. And my producer and partner on the film, David Zellerford, and I have been talking about recutting the film entirely and making it almost a sort of fictional film about how I meet Bert, but how we have a brief friendship and then I never hear from him again, like using the footage in a completely different way. It's not a typical documentary, as I said, because there are things that just aren't addressed. And I honor that. I would, just because he's no longer with us, I wouldn't dream of betraying him. And, you know, if he doesn't want to talk about it, it's, you know, it's fine. I'm friends with his daughter and her husband. I would never want their family to, you know, to have something out there that Bert wouldn't want. But Bert had a very interesting way of, you know, he was a writer too, and he wrote several plays and a couple of movies. And he likes taking real situations and twisting and contorting them in odd ways. So, for instance, he made a movie called Murder on Mott Street. And in order to, he wrote and starred in it, in order to publicize it, he pretended to have been murdered in his house. And he somehow got to, he was dead in a bathtub with blood on him. The pictures got out to the press. There was like briefly like Rocky star Burt Young murdered. Oh, it actually was out there. And, you know, he wanted the publicity, but it also was a scene from the movie. So this was in Burt's head. He was always, like I say, always in puzzles or whatever. So when I started rethinking what I might do with all this footage, I said, well, what would Burt do? Like, what would Bert find amusing?
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought, like, oh, this would be sort of a funny idea, because he'd get it. You know, he'd say, yeah, you told a little story, a little fable about you and me.
That's wicked. Yeah.
I never heard of that when he did that.
No.
Yeah, very much.
I could see that on the National Enquirer or something.
Oh, yeah. He fooled people for a couple of days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you had the pleasure of being with him again on Bottom of the Ninth.
Yeah, yeah. So Robert Brusio, who wrote the screenplay, and I were both Bert friends. Bert and Robert knew each other long before I knew Bert or Robert. And from the minute like we started, we were going like, you know, what can we get for Bert? And it turns out Bert had actually been, Robert had spoken to him about that movie long before I was involved for a different role. For which he was, by the time the movie got made, Bert was just too old for that part.
Mm-hmm.
But we literally just developed, Robert and I went as kind of prep for the movie. We went to Florida to watch some Yankees spring training, which was fascinating. And we found that there was a guy there who was an old player, who, you know, a workmanlike player, you wouldn't really know who he was. And the team kept him around. He was sort of like the mascot. He was an old guy, and he never really had a life beyond baseball. Okay. So he was like their good luck charm. And he'd hang out and he'd tell stories and he'd help them do stuff. He'd suit up, you know, like he still had the uniform. And we went, what a great character. It's like the lifer who really, you're retired from sports early, but 30 years later, that's all he knows. That's all he wants.
Well, hang on.
Still telling the story about the one hit.
That was like that. Let's make Bert that guy. So, you know, yeah, we wrote a little couple of scenes for Bert, and he did them. He was great. And it's very poignant, because he's the old guy who they all love. But
yeah,
you know, what's he doing there? He's hanging out. You know, they make him feel special. And then
that was perfect.
We were shooting the third or fourth night I had him. We were at a very distant location at a ballpark, and there wasn't really any dialogue for Bert that day. And I got the assistant director came up to me, and she was really kind of shaken, and she's like, "You got to get on the phone. I've got Bert Young's on the phone, and he's really, really pissed off." And I was like, "Whoa, what?" Yeah. So I go, "All right, well, let me talk to him." I go, "Bert, what's going on? Where the hell am I? Why am I driving out here for this crap? I don't have any lines. Why am I doing this?" But like, it was just, he was stuck in the car for 3 hours to go to a set where he had no lines. And I got, and Bert was a scary dude. He was, you know, you didn't mess with him.
Yeah.
And I said, just to like, calm down. I was like, "Don't worry, Bert, you do have lines. I have a whole scene in mind that hasn't been scripted for you." Okay. All right. So he comes out, and I had no idea.
I was about to say, you pulled that one out of the air, didn't you?
So he got there, and he goes, "What do you got for me? What do you want? Why am I here?" And I remember this movie. I know. Well, anyway, I remembered this from something else. It was a boxer who was an old guy, and sometimes he would like kind of go crazy and talk about like how he'd wasted his life. Like you could see he was sort of, you know, just knocked out and messed up. And I said, "Bert, how about if like one night you realize your whole life in baseball has just been a waste and you just crack up?" Oh. And he's like, "Wow, yeah, I could, you know." And he goes, "Is it written?" And I said, "You know, you're such a good writer. Why don't you write it?"
Oh, like, my God.
So he had all day. I gave him my little room, my little trailer room. I said, "Just hang out in my room." And he wrote a monologue. And he did it. We shot it. It was the last thing we shot. It is such a moving piece. And it's going to be in my doc, but it didn't make it into the film.
I was going to ask that because Robert, when we had Robert on, he spoke to that it never made the movie. And Tony and I were like, because we're both big Bert fans as well. And we're like, "Boy, we would love to see that, because those are some moments."
It would have been great. It was a very
genius comes out, you know.
Well, also too, Robert didn't tell us the part that Raymond just did that he wrote.
No, by no, he did not share that.
He didn't even mention about that Bert wrote it. So I would love to hear it now that I know that Bert wrote it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will certainly, I'll find a way for you to see it. And I'm going to, you know, the doc will appear one way or another in some form. And that will be in it, whether, you know, no matter what it is. Because it deserves to be seen. It should have been in the film. It shouldn't have been excised.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Yeah. I would love to see that.
Can I ask you a question? Is it okay?
Yeah.
Ask me a question?
I'm yours.
Well, I want to ask Raymond a question real quick. On that is, on the producer director side, do you ever have a say in like your movies of what may get cut and what sticks, you know, and how do you decide that? Because we've talked about that in many episodes as well, as, you know, let's just say with the Rocky franchise, you look at certain deleted scenes and you're like, "Boy, that looks like it would lend so much to the movie, but yet it didn't make it." How does a person go about deciding that? Because you look at it, you're like, "Oh my God, that could have really changed the direction."
Made a difference.
Do you have any say in or any input in that?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, largely it's the director. But not the final say. The money is the final say, and whoever's got the most power, you know, in invested is going to be the final voice.
Gotcha.
You have to do a lot of, you know, convincing and be, you know, seductive and, you know, when you're a director, to get people to do what you want. So I've argued for things that whoever the final has to really, I've had to argue for them, and sometimes I've won. In the case of the Bert scene, nope, I didn't win. I was overruled. But you also have to be tough on yourself. Sometimes things are really good and they just don't belong in the movie.
Okay.
And as the movie is edited, sometimes movies have a way of telling you what they want to be.
Okay.
So it may have looked good in the script. It may have even turned out to be a nice scene when you did it, But somehow when you watch the finished film, and that's a painful thing because you sometimes drop something, you go, I love that, but the movie is better off without it. It's just slowing it down, or it's just not, you know. So
that's really interesting. Really interesting to hear that.
Yeah.
Because I would think that, like you said, if it's so important to the story, you'd want it in it. You'd even be willing to cut another scene. Well, let's get rid of this scene instead. I want this in. But
it's sometimes not just length, though. Sometimes it's not length. It's a little hard to put your finger on it. It just sometimes things throw a movie out of balance, and it didn't appear that way in the script. But somehow later, when you look at it, you go like, "Yeah, it's not really helping us. It's not. It's a good scene, but it's not, you know, helping pull." So it's mysterious. The whole process is a bit mysterious. The more I do it, the more the tougher I try to be on myself before we shoot. To go through the script and really, I say, like, what are the scenes that we're going to drop when we're cutting the first cut of the movie? Because there's always things that you just suddenly you're like, we don't need that. We don't need that. Like, why did I shoot it? So, you know, I try to, but it doesn't matter how tough I am on myself. I'm still shooting things that, you know, you're just come right out when you're editing. You're like, oh, we didn't need that connecting thing. We didn't need that, you know. And when you're making movies on not big budgets, like I usually do, it's a painful waste of time because I could have spent that day, you know, doing something else.
Yeah. That's tough. It's like picking choosing your favorite child, I guess. If you wrote it, directed, produced it, and you got to pick your favorite, you're like, oh my God, that's a tough call.
Yeah.
That's a tough call.
Fortunately, I only have one child, so I don't have
to. Okay.
It wouldn't be that like that, though. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you, yeah.
I have one child, and he's my favorite child. So.
Okay. There you go. There you go. Fair enough. Fair enough.
But we also found out Raymond has a podcast of his own.
Yes.
That he
very
calls,
interesting.
Yeah. I know. Movies Till Dawn, which is an awesome logo there, by the way. And, I see on there when I was reading about what you did that you worked with, well, interviewed on your show, Mel Brooks.
Oh, yeah.
Legend.
Yeah. Mel, that was a very nice, I've been friends with him over the last decade. He doesn't do interviews lightly. He's picky about what he does. And that was just a huge, you know, get for him to do that for me.
Oh yeah.
We did it by phone. He wouldn't do it by Zoom. So the sound is kind of crappy. But that's just how he said, I'm going to do it. I'll call you up, make a tape of it. It wasn't. That was great. The whole idea of that podcast was, I say was because I'm not really doing it now, but they're all out there. You can listen to them. I wanted to talk to veteran filmmakers.
Okay.
Not newer up and coming filmmakers, but people who had really done it and worked a lot. And sure. I realized I knew a lot of them. So I said, I could just call them and record these things and I'd have a podcast.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I did it. And that's what it is. And it's all, well, so I got, cool. as you probably know, I hope you know that John Avildsen is one of the guests. And John and I were friends for the last 6-7 years of his life.
That's great. Wow.
Yeah, definitely go check it out. I mean, it's on Spotify. There's a couple other venues that it is on, and it is audio. And I know you're not doing them anymore, but to hear the interviews would be, I mean, Mel Brooks, back Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein and High Anxiety. And I remember when I was a kid, I was not supposed
History
to
be
watching
the world.
Them. I was 12. So, I mean,
you weren't supposed to be watching
to
that
interview. Oh, God, no. I didn't even get half the humor.
Yeah,
I just knew it was funny though.
Yeah, you can't get away with that these days.
No,
my
no,
goodness, no. What a career! What a...
Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah,
Lord,
that's a different. It's a very different world.
Yeah,
it is a very absolutely true. Absolutely,
I'd rather a Mel Brooks world. I'm sorry, thank you.
Oh yeah,
just my
100%.
But your Rocky centric. Focus though. I would think the John Avildsen interview would be of more interest to you. But
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love
the
Rocky films. And we actually, our last episode we just did was Karate Kid, which Avildsen did the three of them, all three of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would love to hear that as well. But it's just Peter Bogdanovich you had on there as well. I would, you know, love to hear that interview also. I mean, these aren't fly-by-night directors there.
No, Peter's a wonderful interviewer. He's very charming and loves talking about old Hollywood. That interview is only about his journalist, you know, life with old Hollywood. He doesn't talk about his movies. Because in real life, because I was very close with him, that's really what he wanted to talk about. He loved having known Cary Grant and Alfred Hitchcock and John Ford. They were really still his heroes, even when he was in his 70s. That's who he idolized and wanted to talk about.
Yeah. No, Ableton definitely would definitely love to hear that interview. But you bring, you know, the Mel Brooks into that. It's like, those are just two, you know, faces on the Rushmore, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Yeah.
You know? Amazing stuff.
Well, Raymond, we couldn't thank you enough for being on and sharing all these stories, talking to us about your career. I mean, you have done a lot, my friend. We are looking forward to your Burt Young documentary, whenever and however it's going to come out. We'll be watching for it.
One way or another, I'll send you the scene from Bottom of the Ninth.
Oh, my God. Yeah. We would appreciate that so much.
Yeah.
We'd love to see it.
Yeah.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you for having me. Absolutely.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for joining us, taking the time out of your day, evening, to do this. And, boy, I don't know about you, Tony. I couldn't be happier. This was very exciting.
I was very excited about doing this interview. I was really hoping that this would work, too. So I'm glad it all technically worked and we got it all done. But it was great having you on. It was a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, and great, great stories. Thank you.
Yes. Again. Love them.
Take care.
And thank you again, Tony. Thank you, Ricky.
You too.
Thank you. Oh.
Well, that was about as entertaining as you could get. I could probably talk to him for another hour. I know he wanted to.
I know we could. I mean, I'm like, no, don't shut it off already. But I'm sure
I know.
He's probably got stuff to do, and people are probably tired of looking at me.
I know we were creeping up on that 45-minute mark, and I knew that, you know, he wanted to get going. But no, what great stories and so much insight, and my goodness, how much he's accomplished. So we'll be looking forward to seeing more of his work. Hopefully, we'll get to see the Burt Young scene. And I love
those stories.
I know. That's why I could just sit here and let him talk. I don't even have to ask any questions. Just go.
I mean, the questions came to my mind. When you finally get to get in somebody's ear, and these questions that have, you know, been rattling around in our brains, you know, and we've discussed a lot of those questions over many episodes. We finally got somebody to ask, and you can get an answer. And it no longer becomes a question. It's like, now I get it, you know, which I think is
very, very cool.
Complete full circle. I loved it. Great guy. Love to have him on again.
Absolutely. Well, like maybe when the Burt Young documentary comes out.
That's a great idea.
Obviously, it doesn't look like it's going to be coming out very soon, but he said it will come out in some way, shape, or form. So hopefully looking when that comes out, maybe he'll want to come on and talk about that. That'd be cool.
Yes, Raymond.
So we didn't go back on our word. It was one of the many surprises that are coming. But that's the first one that we talked about. Yep. So we hope you enjoyed it. We hope you enjoyed the interview. Go see his work. Go listen to his podcast. I'm going to listen to Albertson tonight. good stuff. But Raymond, other than
thank
that.
You. Thank you.
Thank you, Raymond. Yeah. We'll see each other next week. Thanks, everybody, for watching. Appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed it. And have a good night.